Andy.
Hey, it's Andy Cohen. Join me on Andy Cohen Live, where it's just you, me, and some of the world's biggest celebrities.
Paris Hilton.
Chelsea Handler.
Seth Rogen.
I love you, Miley. Thank you so much.
You can listen to Andy Cohen Live at home or anywhere you are. No car required. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
Will you take questions on inflation then?
Let's move. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you think inflation is a political liability ahead of the midterms?
Thank you, sir.
That's a great asset. More inflation. What a stupid son of a bitch.
Within about an hour of that exchange, he called my cell phone and he said, "It's nothing personal, pal." And we went back and forth and we were talking about just kind of moving forward. And I made sure to tell him that I'm always going to try to ask something different than what everybody else is asking. And he said, "You've got to." And that's a quote from the president. So I'll keep doing it.
A lot of folks on Twitter yesterday were treating the Biden Fox reporter story as the most important news of the day. The update last night, as you heard there, the president called the reporter after the exchange to clear the air, and we can all move on now. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Tuesday, January 25th. With us, we have the host of Way Too Early and White House bureau chief at Politico, Jonathan Lemire, and president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, is with all of us this morning. I'm in Warsaw, Poland again this morning, where there continues to be grave concern over what Russia will do with its troops on the Ukraine border. The Pentagon says it has put thousands of U.S. troops on high alert as fears increase that Russia may invade Ukraine again. NBC News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Andrea Mitchell has the details.
With fears rising that Russia could invade Ukraine, President Biden considering a major show of force near Russia, putting up to 8,500 U.S. troops on a heightened alert, mostly as part of a NATO response force.
Military action by Russia could come at any time.
The president from Camp David this weekend, reviewing Pentagon proposals to move thousands of U.S. troops to NATO countries around Ukraine, fly bombers over the region, and send ships to the Black Sea. NATO also putting more troops on standby and sending additional fighter jets and warships.
What this is about, though, is reassurance to our NATO allies.
President, after a secure video conference from the Situation Room with European allies, insisting they are united.
I had a very, very, very good meeting, total unanimity with all the European leaders.
But NATO is divided. Ukraine's closest neighbors pleading for help. But Germany stalling on the delivery of German-made artillery to Ukraine. France wanting the European Union, not the U.S., to lead talks with Russia. Russia denies it plans to invade, despite sending more troops and jets to Ukraine's borders. The U.S. now ordering embassy families and civilians to leave Ukraine on commercial flights while they can, and warning civilians not to travel to Ukraine or Russia. Upsetting Ukraine's government, which called those moves excessively cautious and premature. But U.S. intelligence also warns Russia could justify invading by toppling Ukraine's president and installing a puppet government answering to Moscow.
Hey, Richard Haass. So obviously this continues. We've been seeing this, talking about this for a few weeks now. It is a slow a rolling invasion. If an invasion does come, actually, Russia's allowed the United States to sort of gain its footing, for its allies to gain its footing and start supplying the Ukrainians with some of the support, not all, but some of the support that they need. So talk about the timing with Russia. What are they looking at? What are they waiting for?
Well, militarily, Joe, Russia's been ready for some time. And the longer the time goes, obviously, you begin to see NATO take preparations. You see Ukraine beginning to absorb in some weapons. So, in some sense, not waiting is in Russia's interest. The problem there is the Beijing Olympics. And they start in just over a week. Putin's supposed to be there as the honored guest of Xi Jinping. And the Olympics don't end till February 20th. So it's unlikely, I think, that he overshadows these Olympics with invasion. Plus, I think Russia wants the diplomacy to, quote unquote, be seen to play out. I could be wrong, but obviously, but that's my sense. Then given weather, after February 20th, there's only a limited amount of time, roughly a month, while the ground is hard enough to do something really large. But that doesn't mean he has to do anything large. The word invasion is a little bit unfortunate here. I think it's better to think of intervention. An intervention suggests an entire menu of possibilities. And the smaller, more focused the intervention is, the less time pressure Mr. Putin will feel.
So, Richard, the Pentagon went out of its way to say yesterday, NATO is a defensive alliance and it will defend these neighboring countries of Ukraine if something happens. So if there is an intervention, to use your term, what's the next step? Tanks roll over the border, then what?
Well, you continue to see arms go into Ukraine, but not you will not see direct military intervention by NATO forces inside the borders of Ukraine. That will not happen. What you will see, though, is the reinforcement of NATO. And people will basically say, we're now going to take steps to fulfill our Article 5 potential Article 5 commitments, which is the idea if anyone in NATO is attacked. So basically, you're telling Putin, okay, you can do what you're going to do in Ukraine, you're going to pay an enormous price for it, hopefully, economically, militarily, and so forth. One of the prices you're going to pay is we're going to do exactly what you don't want us to do. Increase NATO's presence on other borders of Russia and other parts of your near abroad, which may never be rolled back. One of Putin's dangers here, one of his risks, is that NATO might get stronger, not just to make sure that he doesn't go beyond Ukraine's borders, but also to basically as a permanent feature of a post-Ukraine, if you will, map of Europe.
Richard, in sort of a bizarre turn, we've seen over the past year or two people on the Trump right supporting Viktor Orban and his illiberalism, his attack on Western-style democracy. Now some of those same people are suggesting that we should be supporting Russia or at least not be against Russia in their attack against Ukraine. Can you explain the difference between the United States' relationship to Ukraine and the United States' relationship to Russia, and why we should be far more concerned about Ukraine?
Well, Russia sees Ukraine, particularly Vladimir Putin, as almost an organic part of Russia, that history has been unfair to Russia. Ukraine has been separated from it. There's obviously ethnic Russians in parts of Ukraine and Crimea that Russia already occupies. Same holds for eastern Ukraine. Elsewhere, it's mostly not ethnic Russians. But Russia basically wants to undo the...
I get that. No, I get that. That's not my question. If Americans are saying that supporting Russia is the same thing as supporting Ukraine, and why is America supporting Ukraine instead of Russia, do they have that wrong?
No, absolutely. Russia is anything but a liberal, status quo, peaceful, responsible country. Russia stands for everything in many ways we oppose. It stands for how it's organized and its goals. Russia wants to go back to a world where borders can be crossed with all borders except their own can be crossed with impunity. It's a much more violent world. It's a world where human rights, where economic rights are, of individuals are not respected. Russia represents a very, very different direction, almost a totally different trend or theme of history here. And their goals are not necessarily limited in Europe. They really want to create a world where they are a dominant force in the European landmass.
And what about Ukraine? Not to interrupt, but what about Ukraine? Is Ukraine just as bad as Russia, as these Trumpists suggest?
No, you look, Ukraine's imperfect, God knows. There's a long tradition of infighting, of corruption. Its democracy is not fully grounded. Indeed, one of the reasons, Joe, It's way, way, way premature to talk about Ukraine and NATO, as it doesn't fit many of the prerequisites or preconditions of being a NATO member. But Ukraine is at least headed in the right direction. Ukraine is not a threat to anybody. Ukraine's forces are not massed to invade Russia. Ukraine has internal problems. I get it. And Ukraine has not perhaps been as forthcoming as it should be at offering its Russian minority certain degrees of protection and on autonomy. But no one should equate the two. Ukraine is a emerging country that's moving. The arrows are essentially headed in the right direction. The problem for Ukraine is Russia won't give it a chance. It won't give it time or space.
Well, the Wall Street Journal editorial board this morning says the United States can't stop the invasion, but it certainly can raise the cost. And it writes in this, President Biden is considering troop deployment along with ships and aircraft to NATO allies like Poland and the Baltic states that are closest to the Russian threat. Go ahead and send them, sir. Mr. Biden's strategy of restraint in the hope of not provoking Vladimir Putin has not worked. And by the way, it never works. It didn't work with Bush. It didn't work with Obama. Donald Trump bending over backwards didn't work. Restraint doesn't work. Denying Moscow control over Ukraine is in the U.S. national interest. The consequences will extend far beyond Ukraine as other American adversaries try to assert regional dominance. Mr. Putin could look to the Baltics next, while Iran and China also have malign aspirations. Authoritarians are seldom content with merely controlling their own people. The U.S. and the West need to be prudent about when to push back against regional aggressors. But helping Ukraine stay out of Moscow's maw is crucial for preventing a larger threat to European peace. And it seems to me, Jonathan Lemire, as we talk about the delays that have been made over the past several weeks, Russia not moving in quickly when it could have, it seems that the Biden administration in some ways starting to get its footing, the allies starting to get their footing. Most are lining up other than the Germans, which, again, is just deplorable what the Germans are doing right now. But most are lining up and getting ready to make Vladimir Putin pay a cost. Is there a change of attitude inside of the White House instead of where we were a week ago, where it seemed like Biden thought this was just a fait accompli?
Yeah, White House officials have told me that the tone and tenor have shifted in recent days, highlighted by the president's meeting with his national security team at Camp David over the weekend. And it was from that meeting the decision was made here to have these troops ready for possible deployment. There is frustration with the administration. You hit it on Germany. There's not quite unanimity among European allies as to how to handle this Russian threat. So much of Europe depends on Russia for energy, the natural gas pipeline. It's been well documented. There is some belief here. Officials I talked to last night said, you know, that they don't know Putin's timetable. That, yes, the Olympics certainly loom large here, that he may not want to overshadow the Olympics or endanger his relationship with Xi Jinping, the president of China, who, of course, has put a lot into making sure the Beijing Games go off without a hitch. But he's an unpredictable actor. And we heard from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki yesterday saying that an invasion, were it to happen, could happen at any time. Aides also point to me out that there are some Russian military drills scheduled for the region right after the Olympics. And that's something they're watching carefully, too, that potentially could be go time if this were to happen. In the meantime, we're going to see in those couple of weeks American forces trying to potentially a stronger deterrence from the U.S., reinforcing allies to try to prevent military action.
So, Richard, what have we learned about Vladimir Putin in the couple of decades he's been in power? What should the White House be looking at in terms of what he actually responds to? It's been pointed out many times that he's shrugged off sanctions for the most part, but real sanctions have real impacts on those oligarchs, cutting them off from the Western banking system, things like that might put pressure on him. Are preemptive sanctions on the table, and is that a good idea?
I don't think sanctions are going to do the trick. Putin's been very clever, reducing his vulnerability to sanctions. He's amassed on the order of $500 billion, with a B, dollars worth of reserves. You know, I've read recently that his budget calculates in order to break even, they need an oil price in the 40s. Oil's more than twice that now. For Putin, who's a big oil exporter, that's an enormous cushion. He's got China. One of the reasons I think he's unlikely to rain on Xi Jinping's Olympics parade is China is part of his cushion again in order to protect him against the impact of sanctions. So if he's denied certain access to the American-led global economic order, he's got some other alternatives. And since what you're having is a kind of authoritarian international and telling the Americans, you don't control everything. You control part of the world, we get it, and you're part of the banking system, but we have alternatives. Let me say one thing also on what Joe is raising, the Wall Street Journal editorial. It's one thing to prepare for sending all these forces to allies. I get it. That's a smart thing to do to reduce any warning time if we have to do it. But I don't think we should do it yet. The whole idea is to signal to Putin that's one of the prices you will pay if you go ahead. The whole idea is to still change his calculus about the costs and benefits of going in. So I think we're exactly right to prepare those forces, put them on a short warning time, but not to send them yet. That ought to be held in reserve. We can do it if that time should come that Putin actually intervenes in Ukraine.
So I'm looking at this piece, Richard, Joe, Willie, and John, by Fiona Hill, who was in charge of Russia and Eurasian affairs for President Bush, President Obama, in the NSC under President Trump. She has incredible insight from two decades of observing and analyzing Putin's moves. And in the New York Times, she writes this. Putin wants to give the United States a taste of the same bitter medicine Russia had to swallow in the 1990s. He believes that the U.S. is currently in the same predicament as Russia was after the Soviet collapse, grievously weakened at home and in retreat abroad. He also thinks NATO is nothing more than an extension of the United States. And here's one more point here. This time, Mr. Putin's aim is bigger than closing NATO's open door to Ukraine and taking more territory. He wants to evict the U.S. from Europe. As he might put it, goodbye, America. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. We'll be talking about this a lot more throughout the morning. Now to other news-making headlines this morning. Wall Street marked one of the best market comebacks in a long time yesterday, with all three major indices finishing on a high note. Investors began Monday's session dumping technology shares. At one point, the Dow Jones dropped more than 1,000 points, but shares rebounded as the day went on. President Biden, meanwhile, joined the White House Competition Council for its second meeting yesterday to discuss efforts to lower prices and combat supply chain shortages for American consumers. Joining us now, CNBC Global Markets reporter Seema Modi. Seema, a lot going on.
Absolutely. Good morning, Mika. A dramatic rebound on Wall Street yesterday, with stocks falling precipitously at the open. And then really in the blink of an eye in early afternoon, we saw the market stage this big recovery. The carnage was really centered around technology stocks. Investors recently have been questioning whether in a rising rate environment, these companies like Facebook, Google, Apple, that have taken out debt, can continue to outperform. Now, the Fed's two-day meeting does begin today, where the focus will be on just how much the central bank plans to raise rates. Is it three or four times? The exact plan, that is what Wall Street wants to know, on how the Fed plans to combat high inflation. And the timing, right now, the expectation from investors is that multiple rate hikes will begin in March. So Chair Jay Powell, he's got a busy 2 days ahead of him. The commentary from him will be key. And the market, of course, will be hanging on every word. We're also watching earnings. We are in the thick of earnings season right now, Mika. Big heavyweights, which really could set the tone for Wall Street, from General Electric, 3M set to report today, Apple, Tesla later this week. That will provide investors just a better gauge on how some of the biggest names on Wall Street are coping with these persistent concerns around inflation, supply chain, and the broader slowdown in China. Now, the discussion on Russia and Ukraine, the prospect of an imminent invasion, certainly coming up on Wall Street notes right now. But right now, the key focus is the Federal Reserve.
So, Seema, let's talk about tech stocks. Obviously, they've gotten off to a horrid start this year. But yesterday was just a tale of two markets. Why the rush in halfway through the day after things were going so badly? Did you have investors trying to buy the lows? And is there any reason to believe anything's changed fundamentally and those tech stocks won't start going back down today?
Well, right now, futures, Joe, do suggest that the market will start in negative territory. We're looking at stocks in Japan hitting a two-year low. The focus around technology has really been around, yes, this is a sector that has done very well since the onset of the pandemic. And in fact, if you look at the S&P 500, technology has been the biggest winner. We've seen the biggest rebound in those companies. So there have been this broader conversation around valuation. Should these stocks run up this fast? Does it make sense? And again, if the Fed is expected to turn the tap on, continue to raise rates in an aggressive manner, can these larger companies that are sitting on debt, that rely on a lower rate environment, can they continue to do well in this type of move? Now, in terms of yesterday's dramatic rebound, a lot of assumptions being made. Yes, perhaps investors coming in midday to buy the dip. Perhaps many people thought that the sell-off that we initially saw was overdone. Today's performance and the weekly performance, that will perhaps provide just better look at how investors are placing their bets. And of course, what we hear from Powell, Joe, that will be key as well.
All right.
CNBC,
thank you so much.
Seema Modi, thank you. Thank you very much, Seema. Still ahead on Morning Joe, new signs that Omicron may have reached its peak. We'll talk to the U.S. Surgeon General about the case rates trending downward across the country. Plus, coronavirus has had a clear impact on students. New data shows graduation rates taking a dip. Also ahead, more trouble for British Prime Minister Boris Johnson following news of a birthday bash during COVID lockdowns, and a story that will have you checking your spam folder this morning. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Welcome back to Morning Joe. Lights still not on at the White House, 6:24 in the morning in Washington. A grand jury request has been approved in Georgia's largest county in the investigation into possible election interference by former President Donald Trump. A Superior Court judge made that decision yesterday after the request was submitted by Fulton County's district attorney last week. She is investigating whether the former president tried to overturn his 2020 election loss in the state. The scope of that probe includes Trump's now infamous phone call to Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger just days before the Capitol attack.
I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more that we have. There's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated.
When the grand jury convenes in early May, we'll have the power to subpoena witnesses who so far have refused to testify. In response to the DA's request last week, Trump claimed his phone call with Raffensperger was, quote, even more perfect, in his words, than his phone call with Ukraine's president, the one that got him impeached in 2019. It's hard to imagine, Jonathan Lemire, a phone call more incriminating than that one we just played. The tape of the sitting president of the United States asking the Secretary of State in Georgia to find the votes to give him that state. We should point out again that the state of Georgia has counted its presidential votes three times, including once by hand, all showing Joe Biden winning that state.
Yeah, the investigation is to whether or not then President Trump tried to overturn his defeat in that state. Spoiler, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we got that. But yes, that phone call obviously is going to be the center of this. He hits the vote total to a specific vote total that he needs to overturn the result. He's leaning on a fellow Republican there, the Secretary of State Raffensperger there. A lot of legal experts have suggested that this case actually poses more legal peril to him than some of the others that have been circulating. Those in New York, there's been still the indication whether Washington, D.C. might investigate his words leading up to the insurrection. But this is something to watch carefully. The next step will, of course, be subpoenas. Whether or not Trump himself or those around him, some of the aides who were in the office that day, including Mark Meadows, maybe they will get them. Will they be forced to testify? But that we'll find out in the spring.
Mika, we know that former President Trump worked around the clock in a number of states to try to get the vote totals flipped, but not as explicitly have we heard it as we did on that phone call to Raffensperger.
That phone call gets worse with time, if it's possible. I mean, it was bad when we first heard it, but hearing him say, you know, you can simply say that you recalculated. Right. I mean, my God, as corrupt as it comes. Let's go across the pond now. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing new allegations. He broke coronavirus pandemic protocols while the rest of the country was under a strict lockdown. According to ITV News, Johnson held a birthday party at 10 Downing Street, a breach of the government's ban on indoor social gatherings at the time. Johnson has been criticized for attending various events during the country's lockdown. He publicly apologized for attending a garden party, but his office says other gatherings were for work. Johnson's own political party has turned on him for the scandal, and an investigation into his alleged attendance is ongoing. So, Joe, I don't know. Boris Johnson's just a party animal, I guess. He just has party. He's got to have his party.
He's got to party all the time. Party all the time. Party all the time is Rick James,
party
I
all
think.
Night.
Was Rick James the one that said, my girl likes to party all the time? Eddie Murphy? Eddie Murphy. That's right. I don't know how I forget
that.
Boris
really, Johnson.
Guys, Eddie Murphy had a hit. Yeah, and Eddie didn't get in trouble for saying that. All right, so all of this leads me, as I wake up to breaking news from the BBC, that now the police are investigating this garden party, Richard. That leads me to just ask a question. Is everything going so well in Great Britain that they can stop the entire country? Because I think at this point, I really admire that country for having everything together so much that they can literally shut down a country over a garden party and suggest that this is the most important thing going on in Great Britain. I mean, come on, at some point, slap him on the wrist, keep going, worry about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and Brexit and, well, again, whatever problems Great Britain have, but they have to be bigger than this.
They are, but Boris Johnson dominates English public and political life almost in a Trumpian fashion. And what he did here was the hypocrisy of calling upon the entire society to make great sacrifices while he and the people around him were not really struck a nerve. And behind this, Joe, is really Brexit. Boris Johnson is the personification of Brexit. So, yes, this is about the hypocrisy of the party, and we'll see whether there's a vote of confidence and whether this party challenges him. My own view is he does probably survive, but too soon to know. We have to wait for this civil service report to come out in a couple of days. But this is really as much about the direction he's taken the country, and I think people are exhausted with him. They're unhappy with, many people are unhappy with Brexit. The reality is far below the promise, the lie. Are catching up. And Boris Johnson he constantly changes the conversation. Again, it's Trumpian. And the question is, so that's what this is really about, more than the party per se. It's about his leadership. Labour's powerless to do anything. So it's really up to the Tories, you know, his party, shall we say. And, you know, and we'll see, sooner or later, the act will get old and he'll come down. My guess is not quite yet. But this is really about his governance, Brexit, state of the country, which is a great, and like here, by the way, people are just sick of, if you will, of COVID. And there's a kind of exhaustion that's hitting the country. He's trying to, by the way, change the conversation, as you suggest, for Brits doing more, sending lethal aid to Ukraine. But I don't think that's quite, shall we say, grabbing public or elite attention.
Yeah, it's gross hypocrisy, if not a crime. Joe, a quick update on My Girl Likes to Party All the Time. Rick James did produce and write that song. Eddie Murphy who performed it, went to number 2 on the Billboard charts. The song came out as a bet between Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor about whether Eddie Murphy could sing. It turned out he could, and he went to number 2. And that's your update.
See,
on Eddie Murphy's music career.
I knew that Rick James, the spirit of Rick James was somehow involved in that record. But Eddie went to number 2 with that.
Number
Willie?
2 with a bullet. Yeah, he was kept off the top of the charts only by "Say You, Say Me" by Lionel Richie.
Wow, news you can use.
That's a big one. That's a big one, Meek. I bet you.
For all
of you. I bet you slow danced to that in middle school with your blue eyeliner on, right?
Yeah. So for all of you.
The Warsaw Bureau went dark there for a second.
Learned
they did.
A little Polish here. Te jesteś wariatem. J- Joe and Willie.
Oh, come on.
Dziękuję.
Thank you very
Richard
much.
Richard Haas, thank you very much. Look it up and you'll know what I said. But we here in Poland all agree. You all are crazy. Okay. Coming up, a spike in gun violence in New York City has New York City Mayor Eric Adams bringing back a controversial police unit. The mayor will be our guest at the top of the hour. Plus, a music icon has a message for Spotify. Remove a popular podcaster or take down my music. More on that just ahead on Morning Joe.
Each year, the International Rescue Committee's Emergency Watchlist report assesses the 20 countries at greatest risk of new or worsening humanitarian emergencies. These countries are home to only 10.6% of the world's population, but carry a disproportionate burden of global humanitarian crisis. The civil war in Sudan has left over 24 million in need of humanitarian aid, while armed conflicts and natural disasters have displaced 1.26 million people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And Gaza has become the deadliest place for civilians in the world. Donations help the IRC provide families affected by humanitarian crises with emergency supplies in the aftermath of a crisis and with the resources they need to recover and rebuild their lives for the long term. Just $14 can provide a temporary shelter for a displaced family, and $72 can provide 2 months' worth of emergency food for a child. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild.
The Republican majority on the Florida Senate's Education Committee advanced a measure last week that attempts to bar the influence of critical race theory in schools and businesses across the state. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis goes further, supporting a proposal that would allow parents to sue school districts that teach racism-related materials. Meanwhile, a Florida school district canceled a professor's civil rights history seminar for teachers, citing in part concerns over critical race theory, even though his lecture had nothing to do with the topic. For more on this, let's bring in senior national political reporter for NBC News, Mark Caputo. His latest piece delves into what is exactly going on. Also joining us, the host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network, Reverend Al Sharpton. It's great to have you both. Joe?
So, Mark, sort through this for me, okay? Because I grew up in Florida schools, high school, went to law school. Same. In Florida. My kids went to public schools in, in Florida. And, every February, it was nothing radical about it. Nobody was freaking out. In Pensacola, Florida, one of the most conservative areas in America, Black History Month, our children, thank God, would be taught about the civil rights movement, throughout the year. Nobody batted an eye. What's happening here?
Well, I think what's happening here is our broader racial polarization that we're seeing in partisan politics, in part, is as the Republican legislature, as Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, have crusaded more against critical race theory, which they're kind of conflating with anti-racism training, which is, more controversial for a lot of people. It's produced various backlashes and kind of grassroots uprisings. And caught in the middle of this are a lot of school districts. School districts are worried. The school administrators are worried. And especially school teachers are worried. Like, look, if I say something that's interpreted or misinterpreted as being critical race theory, which is really a college level, high level theory that's taught at the university, I could get in trouble. At least that's kind of the point of the legislation. And what you saw here was a professor named J. Michael Butler, who's at Flagler College, was supposed to give a speech, a lecture, an instruction to school teachers in Osceola County, which is in the Orlando area, about what he calls the long civil rights movement, saying, look, civil rights movement wasn't really just limited to the life of Martin Luther King. It started at Reconstruction and it followed after Martin Luther King's death. But he got an email just the day after the legislation you referenced passed, got an email on Wednesday saying, yeah, look, we're going to have to cancel this. There are some various concerns. And critical race theory was mentioned. This was done by a school administrator or the school superintendent, Osceola County Schools. He took to Twitter and we spoke to him. We tried to talk to Osceola Schools about it. And they really didn't want to chat much about it other than say, like, look, this is a problem and we need to discuss it more.
Yeah, and again, let's just, we're going to put three baskets right here, okay? In the first basket, basic civil rights history, which we've all been taught, and it makes us all better, makes us all smarter, helps us put this country in perspective. Then the second is critical race theory, which they were not training there. The third is, like you said, this anti-racism training. And yes, we've seen some anti-racism training that does more than teach you how not to be racist. It's where, you get the white fragility experts coming in and saying that if you're a white person, you're fragile if you don't understand that you're bigoted and racist or whatever it is. But there all those there's also that basket. Those last two are very controversial. From what I understand, in this first basket, that's where this professor was. He was just teaching civil rights and explaining what's happened in this country over the past 400 years.
Yeah, that's very true. And you know, just like you, I went to Florida public schools. You know, there's not a lot of time to really teach the history in the state of both civil rights and about race. But Florida does have an awful history when it comes to race. I mean, one of the reasons Florida became a territory is the United States wanted to expand and protect the franchise of slavery from Georgia plantation owners who were having their slaves run away with Seminole Indians. So the United States invaded the territory of Florida and waged a war of genocide against the Seminole Indians. That's something that's not really taught that clearly in schools. So you had asked earlier, why is this happening? Well, there is a fuller account, a racial reckoning and a historical reckoning of our past in this state and in this nation, which is coming to the fore. And it's producing a lot of tension from people who don't want to hear those facts.
Yeah, and let's be clear, Florida has a horrible issue, a horrible history when it comes to race. And we're not just talking hundreds of years ago. Back in 1968, George Wallace won the Democratic presidential primary. I think Wallace may have won the Democratic presidential primary in 72 as well. Yeah, we have some problems and have had some serious racial problems in Florida for some time. Reverend Al, obviously, this is exactly what politicians like Ron DeSantis want to do. They want to blur critical race theory. They want to blur these theories about white fragility with a basic mainstream teaching of civil rights. Talk about the concern that you have about that.
My concern is that they try and make any discussion of civil rights, of American history, of Florida history, the boogeyman. And they try to merge it all together so that they can race bait and try to play to some voters who may not know the particulars, as you've laid out three different baskets. And really, they put at risk people that would teach American history. Period. How do you do American history and not talk about the Civil War, which a large part of it was based on race, and not be accused if you teach about the Civil War, not be accused of violating the language of what they're saying? You cannot deal with race related things. Well, that can cover any number of territories. And I think that it is really saying that we are going to lie about our history and mislead our children, which does not lead to bringing the country together. Or healing wounds, it leads to a distortion and it leads to people being mistaught. And I think that it is simply some old-fashioned race baiting that DeSantis and others are doing.
So, Mark, there obviously there's some politics at play here when you talk about Governor DeSantis. He's no dummy. He watched what happened in the state of Virginia when now Governor Youngkin talked a lot about schools and talked a lot about critical race theory as sort of a catch-all that, okay, maybe technically graduate-level critical race theory is not being taught in our schools, but our kids are being taught about, at a very young age, about guilt, about privilege, and to identify with their race first and foremost. So how much more do you expect to see of this, as that was a winning formula for Youngkin in Virginia?
Well, actually, Ron DeSantis was one of the first governors in the nation who brought this up before Youngkin had won, I think, even his primary in Virginia. This has been sort of part of DeSantis's political DNA here. The broader movement that you're seeing in conservative circles, which and you're seeing from parents, was concerns over lockdowns, concerns over masking, and then concerns over curriculum. And they've all sort of combined together. Now, you need to point out that DeSantis, a spokeswoman, points out, like, look, the governor had nothing to do with this decision, Osceola County. The governor supports teaching history, she says. What they're against is teaching that whites are bad, and essentially enshrining anti-white racism into curriculum and into work training. Now, again, school boards and businesses deny that they're doing that, but that's the debate, and I think it's only fair to mention what their point of view is. But the reality is this professor who had his lecture canceled, had it canceled by a local school board that was scared, and he said this is an example of a climate of fear where people are reacting to what they think is going to happen, both at the political level, in the halls of Tallahassee, at the grassroots level from angry parents. And that's problematic for teachers of history like him, because he said what suffers, the big casualty, is the truth.
So, Mark, finally, you just dropped a story last night talking about how Puerto Rico Democrats are very concerned about the disconnect between Joe Biden and them, especially on the issue of judicial appointees. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, a bit of a different story. There are three judicial vacancies in Puerto Rico, and the governor, Governor Pierluisi, has some picks. And so far, they have not only been ignored, but other candidates have been advanced from what they understand. And there are very complicated politics in the island. It's not really a Republican-Democratic frame that you hear most often in the island. It's about status. Should it remain a commonwealth? Should it become a state, Puerto Rico? Or should it be independent? And the governor, the resident commissioner, the non-voting member of Congress, Jennifer Colon, and a Florida representative, Florida Congressman Darren Soto, they're all pro-statehooders. And they had found out that one of the candidates being vetted who looked like she was getting a fast track was pro-independence. So this has caused kind of a big brouhaha. And there's a number of people in Pierluisi's circle who say, look, this is a slap in the face to the governor. A state senator there, Carmelo Rios, who was a campaign co-chair for Biden, said that Biden is, and Biden's White House has been tone deaf to the needs and the interests of his allies in Puerto Rico. And this could also have kind of political ramifications. The various Puerto Rican politicians very often come over to Florida and New York to campaign in the Boricua communities here. They're saying, well, why should we do that if the White House stiff arms us, doesn't move ahead with our pro-statehood push and the like? So there's a lot of politics at play. And then I guess behind the scenes, there's the broader issue of Joe Biden's outreach to various Latino communities in Florida, Texas, and beyond. He's struggled ever since he started running for president in 2019 with his Hispanic outreach, and this is just kind of another manifestation of it that we're seeing play out in Puerto Rico.
All right. Senior national political reporter for NBC News, Mark Caputo, thanks for being here. And it's so great to have you here at NBC News. We really appreciate it. All right, Mika.
Thank you, Mark. Well, still ahead, first, she was censured by her party back home in Arizona. And new this morning, a campaign just announced to oust Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema over voting rights. We'll get a live report from Arizona. Plus, Democratic Senator Cory Booker will be our guest. Morning Joe is coming right back. Live look at New York City this morning as the sun comes up. A foggy day in the Big Apple. Here in Warsaw, it's rainy and cold. I've got another reason why you should keep an eye on that junk folder in your email spam. A Michigan woman won a $3 million lotto jackpot. but didn't know it because the notification was stuck in her spam folder. Laura Spears almost missed out on the huge payday, but only realized that she had bought the winning ticket after looking for a missing email from someone else. Phew! The 55-year-old says she's going to use the winnings to retire early and share with her family. That's nice. Check spam. And turning from discovering money on the internet to spending it in very large amounts. A New Jersey toddler went rogue while playing on his mother's iPhone, buying nearly $1,800 worth of furniture. First, flower stands arrived at the door, then household items, then armchair after armchair, all courtesy of the 22-month-old. Through a GoFundMe campaign, Good Samaritans raised more than $25,000 to help the Brooklyn family cover the cost and then some. Hmm. So that's nice, but they have some extra chairs, yeah. Joe.
Hmm. Well, I can relate to that because that's what happens when I give you my phone late at night and you're kind of half asleep and pretty soon, whoo! The next morning, Willie, you would not believe the things that are stacked up outside my door. So you did a little research.
That's you buying me presents.
Go.
I was just going to say, this is a thing, not in our family, but we know many families who young kids are so adept at using devices now, like little kids, that a friend of ours, there was a ring at the door, opened the door, and there was a vacuum cleaner outside from Amazon ordered by their young child. So this happens. In this case, though, I'm not accusing anyone of anything, but, you know, you spend $1,800 to get $25,000 on a GoFundMe. That seems like a smart investment.
I was just thinking about getting a GoFundMe page for Mika's late night shopping sprees. I need the help. So, Reverend Al, Willie and I did a little research earlier, and it's interesting what happens when you do research on the show as well as off. And what Willie found out was I had thought, my girl likes to party all the time, party all the time, party all the time was a Rick James song. Willie tells me it was Eddie Murphy, but Rick James wrote it and produced it. I did a little research because, you know, I had just said that George Wallace won the Democratic primary in the state of Florida. So we did a little research, and what we found was he did, but it was close. In 1972, in the state of Florida, George Wallace won 66 of 67 counties in the state of Florida. Let me say that again. In 1972, in the Democratic primary, George Wallace won 66 out of 67 counties in the state of Florida. So, yeah, Florida's been struggling with racial issues for quite some time. And we continue to, obviously, when professors get in trouble for trying to teach civil rights.
No, well, Florida does have a very serious issue in terms of its history with race. My father came from Florida, a little town called Wabasa, Florida, near Vero Beach, so I know about Florida. And in fact, he and I reconciled years ago. He's living in Orlando now. But I think that since you're doing research in 72, when Wallace won those counties in the Democratic primaries, it was the year Shirley Chisholm ran, and I was a youth director. She did not win 66 counties, though, unfortunately.
Mika?
All right, coming up, New York Mayor Eric Adams joins us at the top of the hour. We'll hear about his plans to crack down on gun violence. Also ahead, we get an update on the Omicron wave from the U.S. Surgeon General. Morning Joe is coming right back.
Hey, it's Andy Cohen. Join me on Andy Cohen Live, where it's just you, me, and some of the world's biggest celebrities.
Paris Hilton.
Chelsea Handler.
Seth Rogen.
I love you, Miley. Thank you so much.
You can listen to Andy Cohen Live at home or anywhere you are. No car required. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.